Welcome to That Anthro Podcast, the podcast dedicated to anthropology. Together, each week, we will be learning from the experts and researchers that are researching our pasts and today's problems. My name is Gabriella Campbell, and I'll be interviewing a new guest each week to bring to you the latest and greatest in anthropology, based right here out of Santa Barbara. Join me for weekly episodes, whether you're an anthropology buff or looking to learn something new. Welcome to That Anthro Podcast. Welcome back to That Anthro Podcast. I'm coming back from a two-week hiatus after I went through finals, and now I'm on my spring break, so I hope you all didn't mind too much, but we're coming back with a great episode with primatologist and evolutionary anthropologist Dr. Nicholas Malone, who is a lecturer, which is the equivalent of a professor, at the University of Auckland in New Zealand. Without further ado, let's get into the episode. Listeners, welcome to the podcast. Today we have Dr. Nicholas Malone. I'm really excited. We have some mutual connections and I'm really happy that we got in touch because, first of all, New Zealand is like one of the coolest places ever. I think every scholar is secretly like, oh, I want to go work in New Zealand. But also just really exciting research that you do in evolutionary anthropology and primatology. And it's kind of something that we've talked about on the podcast, but not in a ton of depth. So I'm really excited to kind of hear the specifics of your work. So welcome.
Gabriella, thank you for having me.
So let's just start with where you did your undergrad and graduate school, kind of what started you on this path to now being, you know, a lecturer at the University of Auckland?
So I was born in Chicago and stayed in Chicago through high school and eventually went to the University of Colorado for my undergraduate and floated around between majors. I think at one point I was officially a philosophy major, but also took geology and just benefited from all these really interesting professors at the sort of the early stages of your undergraduate career. And Boulder was full, so it seemed like every semester I took something new that interested me and I pivoted and floated around a bit. But I guess that's the benefit of the four-year undergraduate degree.
It's really important.
Yeah, and eventually I think it was late second year that took my first anthropology class, and just sort of it had that more holistic lens that brought some of the different information, some of the different interests. You could sort of bring little bits and bobs to bear on some of the questions that anthropology was asking, and so I really liked that, and so I had some really nice introduction to physical anthropology, as it was called at the time, with Dennis Van Gerven, who's, you know, a legend in the field, and eventually took a primatology course with Michelle Sother, and just sort of was, you know, really interested by her teachings about ring-tailed lemurs in the forests of Madagascar, and how their social lives, you know, were so well balanced with the ecological pressures of that context. And it just really sort of, for me, that was it. I was kind of sold on merging sociality and ecology. Next step was for graduate school. I went to Central Washington University for a master's of science, actually, and happened to come across a professor called Augustine Fuentes, who was employed at the time.
I'm familiar with that name.
Central Washington University. He was relatively fresh off of his PhD at Berkeley and just, you know, had the good fortune of having some years of mentorship with Augustine there, and ended up doing my first bit of field work in Indonesia for my master's of science degree. And after that, ended up at the University of Oregon in Eugene, Oregon, working with Joanna Lambert and eventually Francis White. Continuing work in Indonesia, although there was a period of time where I thought I might pivot to field work in either in Uganda or the Democratic Republic of Congo, but I stayed with field work in Indonesia and actually stayed in quite close contact with Augustine throughout the PhD. after the PhD, went quickly on into a short research postdoc with Francis White in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, studying bonobos. And that was a really influential period of time, both for my sort of personal growth, but also professionally, to see a sort of a high profile great ape field site, and to be engaging with communities who have supported that research through hard times and good times, thick and thin. Those folks in the local villages had been really supportive, and to be able to sort of observe how Francis dealt with interpersonal relationships and managed in an extremely professional way her her time in the field site. And so that was quite influential. And of course, studying the bonobos was epic as well.
And also a great deal of change within that country during that time period, if I'm not mistaken. You were there at a very pivotal time for the country.
Yeah, that's correct. You could still sort of see this tail end, the sort of knock-on effects of long wars that had destabilized much of the place. And yet there was still lots of goodwill extended towards us. One of the stories I tell is I sort of was keeping a journal and had these, you know, sort of lists of reasons why I feel safer than I've ever felt in my life, tucked away in, you know, the deepest forests of central Congo. And then another list of why, you know, there were, you know, potential things that I might not feel very safe about. So it was just sort of these contradictions. And that topic of contradictions is something that, you know, I've gone on to continue to explore in sort of primatological practice, is that when I find these moments that are personally contradictory to me, where I might feel strongly going into a situation and then come across information or experiences that make me question those assumptions, I really try to embrace those. And I think, you know, personally, that's made me grow, but also some of the scholarship and the literature that I then incorporate into my current research is kind of plays with some of these contradictions.
Yeah. Could you talk about the work that you were doing in Indonesia? First of all, I'm fascinated with Indonesia as a place. It is number one on my bucket list of places that I want to go next. What were you doing there?
Sure. Yeah. I think the year was 2000, 2001, where I made those first trips to Indonesia. And I was particularly looking at the illegal pet trade. And time, there were lots of NGOs who were just becoming active in monitoring the trade of endangered primates in these public animal markets. And at that time, there was a quite open trade. And so you could walk through the markets and make relatively detailed notes and have conversations with sellers about where they obtained the animals and, of course, what they wanted to sell the animals to. And at that time, of course, there were aspects of that trade that were behind the scenes that were, you know, you'd make a connection at the market, but then the real trade would happen outside of the market. But because those NGOs were so successful in being active and seen in those markets years later, the illegal trade of primates almost entirely went underground. And so you walk through those same markets years later and you wouldn't see any primates for sale. And it wasn't necessarily that you couldn't buy primates through that market, but they were just kept a little bit more off just the main market stalls. And so, especially as a foreigner walking through, you quite signal that there was potential that you were working with an NGO or that you were there to monitor the market and not actually purchase.
Was it typically smaller primates?
There were a lot of the nocturnal slow loris. So those are sort of the small, very cute, but also very nocturnal and stressed by the daylight, active and the heat and the improper diets that were being provided to them. So you saw a lot of sick lorises. And you saw a lot of macaques. So I think macaques were the most abundant species that we documented in the markets, followed next by lutung, which are silvered langurs, and then finally there were apes for sale in those markets as well. And so you would come across the odd gibbon and orangutan. So
Yeah, it just, for me, I've been thinking like even just convenience and able to control, you know, I was assuming that, yeah, that predominantly would probably be smaller primates. And is Indonesia kind of like a hub for that? Or is that just kind of where your research took you?
Yeah, it's, I went there with the explicit goal of sort of examining the primate trade, and Java was the place to be. Java has the largest cities and the most sort of economically connected networks. And so we went through 10 different cities on the island of Java and kind of made a systematic trips to markets to kind of just get the scale of the trade. And that really, I guess, hooked me to studying primatology on Java. And it's sort of this interesting thing that has happened over the years is that many primatologists who do work in Indonesia end up going to some of the outer islands, some of the Sumatras and the Kalimantans and the Sulawesis of the world. And the stop in Java is merely a bureaucratic one to visit Jakarta and to obtain permits and permissions. But then you sort of, once that's all in place, you sort of go out to places where I suppose the forests are a little less devastated. Java has been really decimated in terms of its forest cover, especially in lowland rainforest coverage. And so, you know, people would say, you know, why are you continuing to study primates on Java? The forests are so degraded. Any kind of behavioral study you're doing there probably won't be valid because the animals are merely responding to these degraded habitats. And I guess there was something about that interface, about wanting to know how the primates were responding to these really altered conditions that kept me going. And I think as travelers to Java will tell you, and particularly West Java is where I did most of my work, that every trip you go, you know, you become a little more proficient with local dialects. You become a little bit more understanding of cultural practices and the plot thickens. And so you think you have an understanding of what you observed or what you experienced. And then the next time you go, you sort of ratchet up your knowledge and then you look back on those previous experiences and add some sort of value, interpretive value to those experiences. And so I think there is kind of going back to the same place many times does have advantages. And so you're building up that local network of collaborators and contacts at academic institutions. And it just became kind of my second home away from home is the city of Bandung in West Java, and then forests, nature reserves that are kind of surrounding those areas.
It's really incredible. Did you have a favorite species or monkey that you either worked on or got to just see while you were there?
Yeah, I suppose I was there primarily studying the Javan gibbon, or the silvery gibbon of Java, Hylobates moloch. And of course, being the object of attention, that was always important and attention grabbing when we spent time with the gibbons. But there was another species, Presbytis comata, which is the surili, which is another leaf eating monkey. And that one's quite rare. And so anytime we happen to find a small group or a sighting of the surili, I think that was always cause for excitement. And my field assistants and I, who were, you know, incredibly talented observers of behavior and photographers and had knowledge of the tree species, we all got excited when we came across a surili.
That's really cool to hear. Stunning. Yeah, I want to take this opportunity to talk about field work. And you mentioned that when you were in Congo, you were taking detailed notes. What do you feel like the role is for you both reflectively when you're doing your research? Because, and I, you know, this podcast has an audience of both the public and anthropologists. So let me just deconstruct it for a second. A lot of research that you collect, you're then going to bring back to your lab, to your university, whatever, and really process, go through, you know, come to your conclusions, record everything, potentially write a paper, write a book. So how for you has like that idea of note keeping, whether it's just reflective or actually in the moment helping you kind of process what's going on, how does that function for you?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, Gabriella. I think because anthropology does straddle the science humanities divide, being an anthropologist sort of opens the potential for relevant information to come from, you know, very different avenues. And so, you know, yes, there was time for systematic behavioral observations and sort of meticulous coding of behavior at established times and randomized schedules. But then there was a whole lot of other hours in the day where conversations with local farmers, conversations with political structures in the village where you were staying, conversations with the family who was helping you logistically to stay in the forest. And those became, you know, sort of equally important insights for me. And so I think it's, you feel that privilege of being an anthropologist in a way where you are open to these different channels of information. And eventually, because of the theoretical frameworks we're using, you might call it ethnoprimatology or multi-species ethnography, we're really interested in these entangled interconnections between human life and life beyond the human. And so looking back, I think I was fortunate to have the mentors I had and the influences and the context where I did that field work to be able to kind of eventually pull it together and bring it together into a bigger story that includes ethnographic insights, but also ethological insights.
Yeah. I found even in just a normal traveling non for research that just writing down what you did that day can be such an important reflective, but also introspective tool to kind of really recognize how your experiences within a different culture, you know, make your experience. I'm really glad someone really encouraged me to do that when I went to Japan. And I'm still very thankful that I have, you know, those notes because, you know, memories fade, sadly.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. And photographs and recordings and different ways of opening the senses, I think, to be present in a place. So you kind of, and I guess that's a bit perhaps out of step with maybe a more mainstream or traditional primatology, where the observer is meant to minimize any bias and put practices in place that would take away any of that kind of interpretive lens. But at the same time, I kind of always thought of myself as an anthropologist who happened to be studying human-primate interface as opposed to specifically narrowly focused more on the animal behavior, although I didn't collect animal behavior data and have contributed somewhat to conversations about given social systems.
I think there can be a real benefit to not necessarily boxing ourselves off so much as researchers, because in reality, we're not boxed off, even if we want to put a label or box on it. You know, we've all been through similar training, albeit different. You know, that's something that I've really realized in pursuing, you know, graduate studies, realizing that I am interested in, you know, a lot of things, which sometimes can come off as being unfocused.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess circling back to your original question, which was what led me to New Zealand and what led me to the job as an academic, I think the equivalent would be, on the tenure track, assistant professor track. Here we get hired as lecturers and eventually move up into the ranks of senior lecturer and ultimately into the professoriate, associate and full professor. And so I had applied for a job post-Congo teaching a bit of adjunct work and sort of that that labor that academics do post-PhD, which is a little bit underpaid and overworked, but it's an opportunity and you have to, I guess, try to make the most of it and try to develop your teaching game and continue your publishing. And it's a really challenging phase, you know, thinking about you and you're heading to graduate school. And there is this kind of, this chapter that comes after the PhD that's, you know, equally as challenging, if not more so. Fortunately, there was a job opportunity at the University of Auckland and I applied for it and ended up with the job. And that was a phone call. No, that was a Skype video call for the interview. At that point, they weren't flying folks out to do formal.
I was going to say, they're like, here's a couple $1,000 for all of our applicants to fly to New Zealand.
Yeah, that's right. And so, there was a lot of pressure, I think, hanging on that Skype interview, but fortunately managed to convince the colleagues that they could offer me a job. I had never been to New Zealand, and it all felt like a grand adventure. And 12 years later, and a daughter born here, we feel very much part of the furniture, as they say.
That's awesome. I'm really glad that, you know, that it's been a continued enjoyment. What are some of your favorite classes to teach, or maybe broadly subject areas?
Yeah, so we're really lucky here in that we get a nice balance of being able to teach at the undergraduate and the postgraduate level. And so I teach everything from our stage one introduction to biological anthropology, or that course has morphed a little bit recently to be a little bit more holistic and include other anthropological subdisciplines. And so all the way through the middle stages of the undergraduate years, teaching courses such as primate behavior ecology and conservation, which is of course sort of right up my interest area. And then at the graduate level, we teach theory seminars to our postgraduate students who are pursuing their qualifications beyond the undergraduate. And those are students who are taking that sort of seminars and practicals, developing their skill sets prior to beginning an independent research career as master students. And we're somewhat of a closed market. A lot of our research students have come up through our ranks. Mm-hmm. So you get to know these students quite well. And yeah, I've just been lucky over the years to have some really talented students who I taught them at the undergraduate, I taught them at the postgraduate, we supervised their MAs and even their PhDs. And yeah, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention folks like Allison Wade and Alexandra Ali Palmer, who have just gone on to, you know, to have PhDs and to have research careers. And you know, you're sort of attempting to supervise and facilitate their trajectory, but with those strong women, it was mostly getting out of the way and letting them them do their thing, because they're just some really talented students here in New Zealand. So
that's incredible. Are they still working in New Zealand?
Yes, indeed. Allison Wade was an amazing story. She studied Cross River gorillas and the Nigerian Cameroonian chimpanzees. Wow. At a time of an Ebola outbreak and militia activity, and the university wanted to pull her out of the field site almost as soon as she got there. This was in 2014, I think. And she stayed the course. We lobbied for her, and I think we ended up with some kind of private insurance negotiation that said we'll be responsible for getting her out if it came to that. She ended up doing a year of field work and came back and was nearly complete with her writing up her PhD thesis, and then gave birth to beautiful twin boys.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, so she's a great story. And so she's doing a bit of a mom chapter at the moment, but we're continuing to publish she's been sort of, a right-hand person for bouncing ideas off of, and that's great. Alexandra Palmer, Ali Palmer, the other student I mentioned, she did a really innovative master's thesis at the Auckland Zoo, where she looked at a nice mixed model approach, looking at ethological observation of the orangutans, and then got this great ethnographic insight by working alongside the husbandry staff and interviewing them, and just sort of had this really nice anthropological assessment of the sort of human orangutan interface. And we had insights into how the keepers perceive the relationships among the orangutans, and then looking at what the ethological data said about that, but also questions of ethics and empathy in the husbandry staff. And so she went off and did a PhD in the UK at University College London, and also on orangutan conservation. And then now she's come back to New Zealand. Then just in the last few months, she's obtained a postdoc, and she's now doing a long-term project here in New Zealand on the question of predator-free by 2050 is the organization that is funding her postdoc. And so we have lots of native bird species that are threatened by invasive animals such as stoats and rats, who can hunt these ground nesting birds and importantly their eggs. And so the public does seem to have a sort of overwhelming appetite for rather aggressive anti-predator measures to eradicate these pests. And Ali's kind of doing the social science side of that coin and getting into some really interesting questions about sort of ethics and ethics of eradication. And so that, yeah, it's kind of a bit of a sidestep for her, but
really cool though.
It allowed her to come back to New Zealand at a time when we had some challenges due to the pandemic with getting work and getting research opportunities. So I'm really pleased for her.
But also, isn't it true that before humans, New Zealand, the largest mammals were birds?
There was a mammals. There was a there's a small eared bat, and there are bats, and there are sea mammals. There are coastal mammals, small dolphins, and some pinnipeds. But
yeah, I think birds the really large terrestrial birds. So that's interesting about that predatorial comment, just because if you really think about the whole history of New Zealand, it's predators of that nature are very limited. It's really really introduced, especially when you're talking about an island where you can really determine when things were brought in. On the topic of students, what is some of your advice that you would give to scholars that are kind of looking to follow a similar career or gain exposure in the field of primatology?
That's a great question, Gabriella. And, students sometimes just have this drive and they have this passion, and that's always a great thing to have to start with. Some of the skills, whether it's GIS or statistics, you can pick up those skills, but the passion is hard to find. And so I guess one of the first things is to be brave and follow your interests and follow your passions, which, I understand it's easier to say that than to be a student facing debt and facing options and necessities in life to pivot away from academia. But I guess if you can stay with it and follow those interests, even if you eventually leave academia for the sort of private sector, I think you'll be enriched by the insights you obtained. Be proactive, I guess, in trying to form relationships with professors. Oftentimes we want, we're very busy people, but the thing that we always tend to make time for are our students and student interest. And so again, being brave and trying to form those relationships, it's one of the things you can get out of higher education. I think in particular, with the pandemic and the shift to being online, it's probably the thing that has suffered the most, in that teaching online, we've got tools for information transfer, but there's limitations on the kinds of relationships we can build. And I think that is the biggest loss. And I do feel, for students who have now coming into multiple years of their degrees, where they haven't had that full experience and that opportunity to build relationships with the academic staff.
Yeah, as a student who's been dealing with that, I feel like for me, that was one of the instigating factors in wanting to start a podcast, was that hoping that, for me, the podcast functions on a lot of levels. It functions for people that are in the field that want to keep up to date with their fellow colleagues, new publications, but also for the general public. And then also on the third level, for students that want to learn more about professors, students that are not necessarily sure what niche of anthropology they fall into. So I think you're right, we don't have the tools, but also we have to take steps to try and become a, an anthropology community, even outside of, physical conferences and stuff, even, on social media and in ways like that. I know anytime someone reaches out to me, I'm so excited. I'll have a whole conversation with them on, social media about how I can help them, if, advice, connecting them with someone. It's really it has had those downsides, but I think it's also forced some people to be more creative and come up with new ways to foster those connections.
Yeah, that's amazing. Congratulations on the success of the podcast. And I can see that just for, as an outside observer, how the network you're building, you've created space for these conversations. And that's just awesome.
Thank you. Yeah. But I think also it'll be, you know, as podcasts, other media forms involving anthropology. For example, we had a guest on who's creating, you'll love this, an evolution board game. It's called STEM Sapien Games. Well, that's the company. I don't remember the actual, oh, it's Evoham. Yeah. Anyway, it's you're each character is a different hominid creature, and then the whole game is about the environment and like subsistence and tools and everything. Anyway, so whether it's things like that or podcasts, it'll start to be able to be things you can incorporate into your classes, which I think will be so exciting. And this new wave after the pandemic of incorporating all the new and fun ideas that people have come up with. Rose, we love you. Shout out to STEM Sapien Games.
Awesome. Yeah, and it keeps you young, I suppose, because students have a much better acumen with digital environments than some of us do. And so trying to meet them in a space where they're comfortable interacting and contributing has been a challenge that I think on the other side of the coin, that staff and faculty are trying to find those connections. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah. Well, let's transition into what you've done recently, which is, there was one paper I want to talk about because I'm going to be pursuing a master's in bioarch. So when I saw that you collaborated on a bioarch paper, I was like, oh, well, I have to ask him about this. Yes. So it was called Human and Animal Interactions with Disease. And just tell me about that, because I know, you know, it was co-authored and I'm assuming you focus on the animal side. Someone else is focusing on the human side. Yeah, tell me all about that.
Yeah, that's right. The lead author was my close colleague, Judith Littleton. And she had signed up to contribute this manuscript for a special edition. I believe it's in Bioarchaeology International.
Yes, and I think I read that.
Taking kind of a One Health approach, a holistic lens on this sort of, yeah, again, human-animal interface in the bioarchaeological record, in contemporary interface between humans and animals, and kind of drawing lessons from those sort of disparate contexts. And so, Judith and Sarah Karstens, who is a PhD candidate, who is also on that paper, did an amazing job of framing the article and setting the stage for a couple of small case study contributions. And I think that's where myself talking a little bit about the human-macaque interface as a kind of tried and true lens on how humans come into close contact with primates, with pathogens, and sort of lessons learned from that context. And also Mark Bussey, who's a social anthropologist here at the University of Auckland, also contributed a case study from his research in Papua New Guinea. And so it was a nice collaborative effort, and it brought together the different sub-disciplines here at the University of Auckland, which is something that is a strength for us here. And I think our students benefit, and actually the academic faculty benefit from the fact that we have good open lines of communication. We have a shared seminar series. And so it's a tradition and a history of working seeing ourselves as a holistic anthropology department. We do recognize our sub-disciplines and have sort of, you know, some distinct teaching trajectories and supervision for our MA and PhD students. But at the end of the day, we here at Auckland can get in the room and sit through each other's presentations of research ideas and have, you know, contributions and comments to make. And that builds you as a scholar, I think, and it keeps your anthropological machine tuned a bit. And so you're not sort of too cut off from the other sub-disciplines. Yeah. And again, that's something I really like and appreciate about being here.
Yeah, I think that's a really great point, and I'm glad that you brought that up. I think, you know, as universities evolve and change, it's cool to be able to say that you're, you know, you and your co-professors are part of that change and a part of being more unified and producing really great work, because that's what comes from all the, you know, really brilliant researchers collaborating is, let me tell you, some really great research. That's what comes out of it. Yeah. let's talk about your book now, which is exciting. You mentioned it came out in about around October / November, called The Dialectable Primatologist. When did the idea for a book first come? And we'll start there, actually, and then I have a follow-up question.
Yeah, that's a great question. Where did the idea come from for the book? I think probably there were many conversations had at international conferences when I could, you know, make it to conferences overseas, and I'd meet up with old colleagues, and especially my former advisor, Augustine Fuentes. We would kind of, you know, chat throughout the conferences and talk about different presentations that inspired us or challenged us or made us think differently about the primatology that we were seeing presented at these international conferences. And eventually Augustine was a series editor for a Rutledge series called The New Biological Anthropology. And he said, would I be sort of prepared to try to commit to a schedule to produce a book for that series? And I agreed. And I think I agreed because I felt like I had maybe something novel to contribute based on these experiences that I've had, as we've been talking about, this kind of balance of the science and humanities. I had studied gibbons in the wild and bonobos in the wild, and had captive studies that I had conducted on chimpanzees and orangutans. I had supervised the aforementioned students I mentioned on projects with gorillas. And I just felt like I had a decent coverage of ape studies across various contexts in the wild, in captivity, in these, as Iris Braverman calls, these gray areas, or these gray spaces that are neither captive nor wild, places like heavily managed nature reserves or rehabilitation centers where displaced primates spend a short period of time before maybe being reintroduced. And so, I just thought there was some novel contributions to make. And then thinking back to my time at the University of Oregon, I was close friends with some sociologists, in particular environmental sociologists, who had a very strong Marxist tradition at the University of Oregon. And so incorporating some of their sort of philosophical and theoretical approaches to sort of the nature-culture divide. And so I think that's where, just pulling those different influences together, and it landed with this kind of, the title of the book was The Dialectical Primatologist, which is a strong reference to a 1985 book by two very esteemed ecologists, biologists, geneticists, mathematicians. They were polymaths in the truest sense, Richard Levins and Richard Lewontin, and they wrote a very consequential book called The Dialectical Biologist in 1985, and that was a strong influence for me. And so with some trepidation and maybe foolishness, I called my book The Dialectical Primatologist, in this kind of strong homage for their work. And that kind of set the frame for some of the theoretical framings. But then I populated it with insights gained from those various ape studies.
And what would you say is kind of like a unifying theme or overarching question that you ask throughout the book?
Yeah, thank you for that. I think it's the thing that kept me going were identifying these seemingly contradictory states or experiences. And so whether the question was, quite strictly on social systems of primates, you know, what's driving those social systems? Is it competition at the individual level? Or is there some kind of moderating factor of the group? With research and conservation in primatology, there's always a question of, where do our priorities lie? Do our priorities lie with the protection of as much natural habitat as we can, to the displacement perhaps of indigenous peoples who occupy and use those same forests? Or do we go for a more inclusive approach that tries to sort of see embers of some coexistence that is possible between humans and animals, and try to foster that? how do we see zoos? Do we see zoos as these very active and progressive places where primate conservation is enhanced? Or there's a different literature which suggests that zoos can have a darker side that kind of subtly work to reinforce aspects and beliefs about human superiority. And so it's in these various ways, I kept finding sort of that there's a thesis and then there's an antithesis and trying to work through to find some kind of synthesis. And so I'd say that's the unifying theme of the book.
I'm really glad I asked that because I feel like that answer gives the book a whole new light, you know, in that what, you know, how your experiences have come together to, inform you in the ways that they have. I think the last thing that I would like to touch on is really, you know, about conservation and about your work and why you believe your research is important and why you believe it's important for more people to become primatologists, for more people to care about all mammals, but in specifically, you know, monkeys and their longevity and their survival.
Yes, it is very important that people maintain their interest. There's a whole army of primatologists who do incredible work and are incredibly dedicated to collecting behavioral data, collecting ecological information, to trying to bring that together into policy and create conservation action. You know, those folks are hugely influential and we need more people like that. Mm-hmm. There's also sort of supporting those folks are within primate range countries are your local activists and your nature lovers and your academics in those primate range countries who support the foreign researchers and really do a lot of the hard yards in terms of maintaining field sites and maintaining presence and maintaining rapport with local communities. And then there's insights that can be gained directly from trying to gain the perspectives of local peoples who live and reside and intimately depend upon these forests that sometimes I feel like, you know, we're kind of swanning in and out of these field sites with the foreign conservation money to maybe collect our insights for our next scientific paper or book or policy. But really, we need to, you know, really see that there's really important insights that can be gained by taking those perspectives incredibly seriously and building in ways in which there can be feedback between people and conservationists and scientists. So all of that is really, really important. It does get a bit hard sometimes when we have so many challenges amongst ourselves. Mm. Amongst, you know, we have poverty and education challenges and war and disease and famine, racial relations, all kinds of challenges we have as a species ourselves. And sometimes it feels like, how are we ever going to get it right to interact with other species mm-hmm. and facilitate that coexistence when we struggle, it seems, to even find that potential for coexistence amongst ourselves. And so, there's no shortage of challenges we face, but I guess I remain optimistic that the students who are so talented and driven and just desire to make the world a better place continue to push boundaries and to put themselves into those spaces where they can make a difference.
Yeah.
So that's my hopeful thought. Of that.
And you know what? The end of your argument for that is my argument for why we shouldn't resurrect mammoths or whatever they're doing with DNA stuff. I'm like, we can barely take care of the animal. We can't take care of the animals that are already living. And people want to bring back mammoths. Like, are you kidding me?
Good point.
And the last thing I have for you is just, I always like to end my episodes with kind of the work-life balance. What is your favorite thing to do outside of work in New Zealand, whether it's with the family or by yourself, whether it's outside or inside? What's your favorite hobby activity to take part in?
Oh, gonna make me reveal myself as the secret surfer that I am. Yeah, I pay pretty close attention to the winds and the swell. And I think fortunate to have a bit of flexibility in the schedule. You know, we can choose which 75 hours per week we want to work, whatever the metric is, but we do have that flexibility to get out and spend time in the ocean, which is of course rejuvenating on so many ways, and good for mental and physical fitness, but also just sort of maybe it's the salt water preserves you, tries to keep you young.
Yeah,
as I grapple with.
Thank you so much for your time today. I'm really appreciative, and it was so great to hear more about your research and all of the things that you have to say. I definitely think people should check out your book. We'll have it linked below. We always have information about the guests in the description notes. Yeah, thank you so much.
Appreciate the time, Gabriella, and thank you so much for having me on the podcast.